Okay. Well, Paul, thank you very much for the invitation. And I also like to thank Ed and Bala for including in their talks very nice introductions, both on the experimental side and the theoretical side, making my job a little easier. What I want to talk about two systems, really. Both polar molecules, both studies are on scattering, but for quite different reasons. The first part will be on scattering of NH molecules with NH molecules. And this is a strictly theoretical study, and it is aimed at helping experimentalists maybe achieve cooling to the ultra-cold temperatures of molecules, other than the alkalis. Of course, in the alkalis, experiments have been extremely successful at producing ultra-cold molecules and studying them. But if you start with pre-existing molecules and you could cool them also to ultra-cold temperatures, of course, there would be a much wider range of systems accessible. And that has proven quite difficult so far. And well, as theorists, we try to see if we can provide some data that helps maybe in deciding what experiment to try, because all these experiments always take several years of hard work to get there. So what we studied here is cold and ultra-cold collisions of these molecules in the range from microkelvin to Kelvin. And well, we've already done quite a few of these studies studying elastic and inelastic processes, and here we are also looking at possible reactive collisions. And the key question here is evaporative cooling possible? Because evaporative cooling is one viable method of going from the cold, from cold molecules, trapped molecules, around a Kelvin or half a Kelvin to the ultra-cold regime. And the elastic collisions are what you need there to do the evaporative cooling, and the inelastic collisions are the collisions that change the spin and cause trap loss. And the ratio is determines whether or not the experiment has a chance. And looking only at inelastic channels in the previous studies, the conclusion was, there is a fair chance it may work. Here we look at reactive, and this actually should come out in a few days. And the other system is OH and NO, again, two polar molecules. And here the interest is not really go to the ultra cold regime, but it's a product of the study of cold molecules, where one of the techniques mentioned also by Ad is the Stark deceleration, a technique initially developed to slow down molecules and trap them. But over time, it was realized that these techniques to cool, in fact, also provide a means of just creating a molecular beam with a very well-defined kinetic energy and molecules in basically pure quantum states. And so the techniques developed to cool or slow down molecules provide here a means of doing sort of the classical chemical dynamics study at much higher resolution. And well, this will be a project that involves both theory and experiment. All the experiments were done in Berlin, Bas van der Meer, Akker, Gerard Meijer, and at the Fritz Haber Institute. And on the theoretical side, we tried to see if we could understand some of the results of these experiments. So here, the OH is produced with a Stark decelerator, and the NO beam is a hexapole is used. So strictly the OH is the best controlled beam, and the collision energies here, so it's like a cross beam setup, so they're not really, it's nothing cold about it. It's controlled, but the range is 70 to 300 wave number where the experiment was done. And this is a system, in principle, also reactive, but it's the inelastic channels that were studied. And also in the theory, we restricted ourselves to inelastic part of the problem, and so far ignored the reactive part. And in a way, this is a sort of a follow-up of an earlier study where atom molecule collision was studied, also in Berlin, and where we did the theory. And that was actually work, I think, where Steven was involved in the experimental side. So let me start on the NA10H part of the talk. The goal here is evaporative cooling, and basically the what you need is to cool a trapped sample of a gas is on the one hand you can just lower the trap depth. If you have a magnetic trap, you can lower it, and then you first lose the fast moving molecules. But if nothing else happens, then if the trap is switched off, then all the molecules are lost. So what you need is you need collisions to re-thermalize. So if you start with a sample at 1 Kelvin, you can lower the trap depth and lose some of the fast ones, but you have to re-thermalize, and that requires elastic collisions. And so you need collisions, but these collisions can then do harm because they can cause trap loss if you go from a trapped state of your molecule to an untrapped state. And this scheme was actually successful for metastable helium, where this evaporative cooling scheme was actually successfully used to go to create the Bose-Einstein condensate. And okay, so how about the NHMH system? Well, first, I want to show what the chemistry is that is possible. So our starting point in the trap is 2 NH molecules, and here you see on a energy scale, it's in kcal per mole, all kinds of chemical reactions that can occur. Right? This is NH2 plus N and N2H plus H, and this is N2 plus H2. And here you see in different colors possible stable molecules. These ones are the purple ones are singlets, the red ones are triplet states, and provided something can take away the energy, these are in principle stable products that you can form if you start with the NHNH.
I mean, these are stable, you mean they are low minima in the potential surface?
Well, okay, so this is, this is, it's local because the global minimum is N2 plus H2. Yeah. But there are high barriers to go from, you know, for this molecule will not dissociate. Sure. So
this
it's
is also sort of a random order, right? There's nothing, no order implied.
No, it's just these are transition states going from one structure to the other. And so here I indicate some transition states if you want to go from this stable molecule.
I'm trying to understand this graph, but how do I see that these are transitions, that these are saddle points or potential?
So yeah, that is a saddle point, presumably one negative eigenvalue of the Hessian if you go from this molecule to that. But the point is
maybe related to this, is this some effective reaction coordinate
there must be a reaction coordinate going from here to there, but of course it is it's a high dimensional space, so in a plot you only show that
these two minima could be switched around.
In a way you switch only 3 points on the reaction corner, one stable molecule, the transition state, and in between things can move. And then also, one thing of interest here is that also there are triplet states that are more stable than the NHNH that we start with.
I want to imply something like this configuration is in some sense closer to another configuration. between?
No, no, no. This is just overview of possible. It's some points on the potential MSE surface.
So in a sense, this is not quite like a reaction coordinate. It's implying in a very high dimensional space where the minima and maxima are, and not implying a particular time sequence in getting from one.
That is right.
In some sense, it's a very complicated dance on this potential surface, and it's going to hit those minima and maxima sometime during that.
And presumably, you can get from here to these products barrierless. That is important. So. I didn't try to draw a reaction path, but starting here, it's all the way down to these local minima and transition states. So that is important. That is not, you don't have to go over a barrier to get these reactions.
And so your second one down, that's NH2 plus N?
Yes. NH2
that's actually
N.
above all this stuff that goes on in the complex.
Yes.
Okay.
But these were sort of randomly chosen by someone? Or?
Well, I picked them from the literature, so.
So there are no more in local.
I think these. I think we have most of them now, yeah. But I did not explore this part of the problem so much because we have been. These are from the literature. I should have put a reference here. I couldn't find it quickly enough when I put in this slide. So when we do our calculations, we work on this arrangement, and we are assuming that if the molecules get close enough, like 4 atomic units, then if you are in the singlet or triplet state, you can get these products, and then we stop. So we do the, what happens in the trap is the collision there. And once the reaction starts, then you know we believe that some product will be formed. And the question we have is just, will the reaction occur? How the total reaction rate? How will that compare to other to inelastic collisions? Is it important or not in destroying your cold sample of NH molecules?
I'm imagining you're going to do a time-independent calculation of some data set.
Yes.
Will any of these configurations
play
a role in your?
So they're not included. We stop by the time the molecules get close enough, so we can do a calculation that is very similar to an inelastic scattering calculation. Just we have boundary conditions. Well, I'll show that in how we do that, where we say, okay, once you get to here, there's a point of no return. And chemistry will happen, but we come in the trap that is important on the quintet surface. We have 2 triplet molecules. This is what we do. So we have 2 triplet molecules in the trap. Spins are aligned, so initially the complex is in a quintet state. So this is what the spin state in the trap, and here are the singlet and triplet electronic states that do all the chemistry, and we actually calculated the potential energy surfaces for all 3 spin states, where this is some kind of cut of. This potential, it's a 4-dimensional potential. We kept the NH distances fixed, but we include then the distance between the molecules and the orientations, which two theta angles and a dihedral angle, so 3 angles and a distance. So we treated it as a 4-dimensional problem. And of course, when you get really close and you get all these chemical reactions, then these NH bonds are no longer, they will start changing. They may break or form new bonds. That's where we stop. We simply fix them at that equilibrium distance. And so this is sort of a cut through this 4-dimensional potential, where here you have the distance between the molecules, and then here, we chose one, cut through the angle space, and you see there are 3 potentials. There is the upper one is the quintet. And the quintet is non-reactive. So if they come close, there is like a van der Waals complex, and it's bound in the order of 700 wave numbers. But then if you come closer on the quintet surface, the potential is repulsive again. So no chemical reaction can occur. But if you get to the triplet, that's the one in the middle, or the singlet potential there, if you get on these potentials, you go down, and then you go to the chemical valley, which you don't express in wave number anymore, but rather in kcals or EV. That's so here you go down orders of magnitude if you get in the chemical regime.
So the states that you showed the previous slide would be down there.
So exactly. That's when you get here. Yes.
And when you know in what surface you are, you know if there is a reaction on it.
Yes. So we assume that if you actually make it to either of these electronic states at 4 Bohr, you get chemical reaction. So the question is, you know, how to get there? Because in first order, of course, it's, you know, it's a forbidden. You start in the quintet, so you need some small term in the Hamiltonian that will bring you to the singlet or triplet.
Yes. Just a very quick comment about this. I think what you're meaning basically is that you have only incoming boundary conditions. Everything that crosses that boundary goes in. It's like an absorbing potential.
It's yes.
That's kind of related to what Bala was saying about absorbing potentials. Yes. But you're doing it this way.
Yeah.
You just cut, and what goes in never comes out.
And we have a time-independent calculation, so we don't need complex potential to do that. We can use boundary conditions to do a perfect job for.
Yeah. You throw away.
For one energy, of course, you can have flux going in 100.
So it's a non-unitary evolution. In other words, you're taking amplitude out as it goes on.
Yes. So so what do we have in the Hamiltonian to do that? Well, we have the kinetic energy, of course, the radial part, the end over end rotation. Here is our four-dimensional potential. That took some years to calculate. I mean, this is high-level ab initio calculation, many points, analytic fit, a lot of work, but we have that. And then we have the monomer terms, the Hamiltonians of the NH molecules. And there is one extra term that will couple it, apart from the potential, and that is the magnetic dipole-dipole, which is an intermolecular term. That is down here. It goes as R-3, so that is the strongest interaction you have at large distance, because the potential has, well, okay, that is a dipole-dipole, but if you are in a specific rotational state, that averages out, but the spin is aligned in the magnetic trap. So at very large distance, this is the interaction that remains. If you get closer and the molecules start to feel the anisotropy of the potential, then they start to rotate, and then you will get the effects of all these small terms in the free NH molecule. So let's see what we have for the molecule. We have the rotation of the molecule, but there is a coupling between the electronic spin and the rotation of the molecule, and the coupling constant here, I wrote them, so just the order of magnitude, the rotational constant is 16 wave number. Spin rotation coupling is small, 0.05 wave number. That is a spin-spin term in the order of a wave number, and then that is the interaction with the magnetic field, the Zeeman term, magnetic field and spin. So these terms asymptotically, you have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, you get the molecular states. If you get closer, these rotations start to mix through the potential, and then these terms can mix the different spin states. So it's the potential that sort of disturbs the rotation, and then through the other states, the spin starts to couple, and you can go from the quintet to the triplet and singlet.
Okay, so basically the difference between this calculation and Bala's talking about the spin structure is you actually have the full spin structure of the triplet sigma state in there, but not the nuclear spin, just the...
The nuclear spin is not yet considered. Yes, that is right. But we have the singlet, triplet, and quintet in the basis. And and all these terms to couple them. So, well, if we do the calculations in a magnetic field, we use an uncoupled basis, so we have the rotation of molecule A, the spin of molecule A, the rotation of B, the spin of B, and then the end-over-end rotation of the complex. And our initial state, the molecules have no rotation, but that is the triplet state with the projection on the magnetic field of one. And here is the basis set for which I'll show the results. We actually have also some results in larger basis sets. So it's a single arrangement calculation, but reactive boundary conditions, and I'm using the renormalized number of propagator rather than the log derivative. We also, in the results, include the universal limit. So these are the formulas from the paper with Paul and Lisbeth Janssen, the PhD student who did most of this work. She looked up the formulas and just applied in the values that we have for the dispersion coefficient, the reduced mass, and get the universal limit elastic and inelastic, or you can in this case then call it reactive from that, just to compare that model. There's one slide about the number of propagator. So we had to modify, usually the number of propagator is used for inelastic scattering calculations, and we modified it to allow us to do the reactive scattering. There are various ways of doing it. What we do, the point here is that we calculate two independent sets of solutions for each channel that allow us to impose the boundary conditions afterwards. So after we do the propagation, I'll not go into much detail, we can apply any type of boundary conditions we want without having to redo the propagation. So it's not like we start with the incoming boundary conditions and propagate. We first do the propagation, have two sets of solutions, and then can play, because there are slightly different ways in which you can actually choose the boundary conditions at four Bohr. Maybe one quick word: if your total energy is this, and you have a channel energy that is lower, you can call it reactive. If you get to four Bohr, and but you can also consider the slope of the adiabatic potential and say, well, if that slope is this way, then this is really a closed channel, and then you're, so if you, this is this four Bohr, and you're not really doing this propagation, so this is where you stop, but you can make a choice whether you call a certain channel open or closed at four Bohr, whether or not, and so that allowed us to see if that makes any difference. But
is this basically letting you get reflection back from certain channels and not others?
Yeah.
Essentially handling back reflection.
Yeah. Right. So you can, if something is positive, you say, okay, that is closed. If it's negative, if this is total energy, it's open. But here, if you are here, but the slope of the adiabat is like that, then is it open or closed? And this propagator that we wrote allows us to try that out.
Just a comment. This is the essence of what the quantum defect theory attempts to make. If you use complex quantum defect parameters, you allow for passage through a reflection back through certain channels. So that's just a comment.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Cool. We could fit the quantum defect model to the results we get out of this in many ways. Yes. Okay, so here I gave these boundary conditions, let me go to the results. So here, as a function of energy, there's a microkelvin to one kelvin in a magnetic field of one Gauss. I have a number of channels here, and the first one, the upper one, this is the elastic cross-section. This is the cross-section in square centimeter, and it becomes constant at low energy, as it should, by Wigner threshold law. Then here I have the inelastic cross-section, which is quite low, and there we have the reactive cross-section, and that sort of was our first surprise, that the reactive cross-section can be several orders of magnitude larger than the inelastic cross-sections.
What inelastic channel?
So that is just a changing of the spin. Right. Yeah, the channels that give frap loss.
Right.
And until this study, we had sort of totally ignored that reactive part. And yes?
Just a very, very quick question is, since the spin splitting is very, very small, and this is a light mass, is the spin centrifugal suppressed in the exit channel, or is the energy release enough to get away
there? Well, so that basically what you're saying is explaining, I think, part of the difference. Here, you're in the inelastic channel here at one Gauss. You have a centrifugal barrier that you have to go over, either on the entrance or on the exit channel, because if the orientation changes, right, angular momentum cannot, you cannot be S-wave in and out and still change the spin. So that is what is suppressing this. But of course, the reactive part, you don't have the problem on the exit channel. You never have to go over any barrier, right, because you have this, a lot of energy available.
It makes an interesting point. I just make the point that when you have low energy exit channels, you get effects, interesting low energy effects in the exit channels too.
And for the reactive part here, you have not. And of course, it requires coupling, these small couplings to get out of that quintet state. But that, in a way, applies to both of them. Although, okay, we'll see. There are. In addition, there are these dashed results, and these are calculations where we only include the quintet state. So you see, for example, for the elastic cross-section, you don't need to include the triplet and the singlet. That's kind of what you would expect, right? You come in on the quintet. If you look at the elastic processes, you only need to consider the quintet potential. So that is confirmed. And for the inelastic processes, you see, you also can get them from the quintet. So it is possible to go from the quintet to the triplet and then go back out. So an inelastic process that involves a single triplet, it is possible. But so here there is some difference. So maybe that is happening here, but mostly it's not terribly important. Yes.
Question about the nature of the inelasticity. Does it involve changes in the projection quantum number also? Because
projection of the spin.
You consider the collision to be taking place really in the magnetic field. So
yes, okay. Yes, it is. It is only so you can change the projection of the spin. So if you have a quintet state, you can stay on in the quintet, but still change the projection, the total, and that means also the projection quantum number of the individual fragments.
And so your inelastic is the sum of all these processes.
And the inelastic is just the sum of everything. That is yes. Of course, for the reactive, you cannot do on the quintet because the quintet potential is non-reactive. So you only get this if you include the singlet and triplet, and then suddenly it becomes the dominant channel apart from the
right. So the inelastic S equal 2 only is larger than the S equal than the total.
So the dashed line is the quintet only.
There goes up. There's a resonance.
Yeah, here are some resonances, but you see
it's up above the green.
Oh, here, yes. Here is an example where you have a resonance. That is, if you do the calculation on the quintet, of course. Yeah, here where you have several partial waves coming in,
right.
You can have a resonance, and then, well, we'll later show. Then you can get anything.
Right.
Inelastic can be bigger. Lots of things can happen there. Okay, so here I show the cross section at a micro Kelvin, but now as a function of the magnetic field, and for this. Here you see an example where the green is the reactive, is actually larger than the elastic cross section. So at this energy, reactive is the largest. Then here we have the elastic one, and here we have the inelastic cross sections, and the extra results here are where we switch off certain terms in the Hamiltonian to see what is the mechanism that gives the process. So you can see, if you look at this dashed line, that is an inelastic cross section. If you switch off the magnetic dipole, so the magnetic dipole-dipole coupling, that is the R minus 3 term, if you switch that off, the inelastic cross sections suddenly become much smaller. So that is the most important term that is doing the inelastic spin flap. It's a magnetic dipole-dipole coupling. Whereas here you see the reactive cross-section in green and the dashed line, that is if you switch off this intramolecular spin-spin term. That was the NH spin-spin term, the one wave number coupling term. So if you switch that off, suddenly the reactive cross-section drops a lot. And that means that a reaction occurs when the molecules come close and these molecular terms bring you to the singlet or triplet state. And the magnetic dipole is not so important for the
reactive one.
Okay, so this is a plot as a function of the energy again, where you see the universal limit result, and here we have results at different magnetic fields. So let me see. So here we have the inelastic processes at zero magnetic field, and then here this is what happens if you increase the magnetic field. And you see increasing magnetic field makes these inelastic channels more exothermic, and then they go up. And you see in green, again, the reactive ones, they are already exothermic by themselves, so the magnetic field isn't really doing much. And that means that with the magnetic field, we were hoping maybe to be able to control a chemical reaction with a small term in the Hamiltonian, with a magnetic field. But clearly, for this reactive process, the magnetic field is not really going to allow you to do much for that.
But what if you start from this outcome channel? I mean, because the green curve, it's a different, it's a spin flip. Right.
The green curve is the reactive one. So that is where you get chemical reaction and get, well, we don't know what product because we don't go all the way to the products, but you get N2 plus H2 or NH2 plus H. The chemical bonds are broken and changed. And the inelastic is where the molecules stay intact, but only
change the internal
lab. Change the internal, yes.
Internal.
Yeah.
So most of the spin-dependent interactions are this one-wave number negative triplet spin-spin.
Yes, and that is the spin rotation, which is smaller.
And that is probably, I'm guessing, for these small molecule like this, is primarily second-order spin-orbit contribution to that.
Yeah, there is. There are two terms.
I know in molecular oxygen, the spin-spin splitting is almost entirely second-order spin-orbit.
Yeah, it is. It is an effective term in the Hamiltonian. It has. An important contribution from spin orbit coupling.
So that spin-spin term is operative. I have to think a little bit about how this works, but it's essentially getting your spins all scrambled up when they get together in your complex. So you come in quintet, but yet you have to flip over to singlet triplet. And that one-wave number term is what's doing it for you.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. And the operator works because it is sort of tied to the body fixed axis.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the reason you're running roughly, I guess, factor 5 or 10 below in the total reactive rate below the universal dashed line, that's basically saying that the probability of these spins kind of finding themselves over in singlet triplet is maybe like 10% or something.
Yes.
Something of that order.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes? Any one of these reactions. So I guess it goes to another spin state, and so there is a lot of energy in this state.
Yes, they are very exothermic.
So I would say, even if that was spin stretch, but you then you would not be able to trap it anywhere because it has too much.
Oh yes, it has. It totally flies out instantly.
Yeah,
yes, that's absolutely true. maybe one comment on this. The threshold law, because this is a little bit surprising. There's an inelastic channel, and it becomes constant. And that took us a while. We first encountered this behavior a few years ago, and where we had small magnetic fields, and then we got these constant cross sections for the inelastic process, and we could reproduce them in the Born approximation. And it took us a while, but to understand, but why it is different from the normal Wigner. Because it is an inelastic channel. Why, you know, with a magnetic field, Wigner tells you this must happen. If the magnetic field is zero, you have the restriction, the angular momentum changes, you have a slope of two. But we were finding a constant value for an inelastic process at very small magnetic fields and also at zero magnetic field. And the reason this is happening, this comes from the magnetic dipole-dipole term. That is an R minus 3, and it's a process that is happening at the other side of the centrifugal barrier. Yesterday, so if you have a centrifugal barrier, and so this is goes like, the barrier goes like 1 over R squared. Here, if this is the total energy, you can have this inelastic process. So here is the barrier, but it happens outside the barrier. And in the derivation of the Wigner threshold laws, it is assuming that there is some distance, some short range, where something happens. And then you can derive analytically in the limit of energy goes to zero, you know, the probability of getting there. But in this case, this inelastic process occurs on the other side of the centrifugal barrier, and then if you go down in energy, these crossings occur at larger distances, but you know, the R minus 3 and then R squared, and then the fact that, you know, the channels become, the difference in slope becomes smaller altogether. Well, in the Born approximation, it just comes out analytically that you get a constant result. So then the question is, you know, what do all these results mean? Because our potentials are not exact. And we have seen that we then have to test the sensitivity of the results to small changes. And we do that with this the lambda scan, where you change either the potential or the reduced mass. And then you see that results actually vary over, you know, a huge, you know, 10 minus 4, 5 orders of magnitude. The results can change if you change the interaction by a few percent. Here we go 10%. Plus and minus, but then you can compare, and then you see the elastic here is still mostly larger than the reactive and the inelastic, but there are cases where it's the other way around. So if you only, so the green is reactive, so if you leave that out, you see the blue ones, the inelastic ones, are mostly below the elastic. So the chances, so you know, we don't know where we are on this scan. The chances for the experiment to work are still pretty good. But now you see, if you include the reactive channels, they are often above the inelastic. And there are more parts in the lambda scan where, you know, the elastic cross sections are not dominant. So the prospects for the experiment to work just deteriorate if you include the chemical reaction. I have here, okay, two, the universal limit, I think, okay, that is at two different, that are two different magnetic fields. You see here the solid line is 1 Gauss, and the dashed line is at 100 Gauss. So you see, if you go to a low magnetic field, you suppress the inelastic channels. So that sort of helps the experiment a lot. You think if you cool, you can switch off the magnetic field, the ratio becomes more favorable. But you see the reactive cross sections don't do that. So the inelastic process, you can suppress by, if you go to a lower magnetic field, elastic to inelastic becomes better. Yes?
Something that I understand. So in this plot, as a function of lambda, you clearly see resonance in both reactive and elastic cross-section,
yes.
Right? But in energy scan, you clearly see it only on the reactive scattering, right? Some of the elastic looks completely flat at that region. Why lambda shows such a beautiful resonance about energy?
Well, with the lambda scan, you push states in and out of the continuum. And
I would say changing lambda by 5% is a gigantic change. Well, changing from 1 microkelvin to 2 microkelvin is an incredibly small change.
No, it's not 1 to 2. I mean, the resonance was around 100 millikelvin.
Right. Okay. Still, I would say the depth of the potential is about 10,000 Wein miles.
Yes, the reactive part certainly, and the quintet, well, 700 Wein miles.
Okay, so but I don't know, it's 4 poles. Yeah.
Spin
constant is only
about one
additional
constant, right?
But I'm not sure what is
the most
lambda. Not
the
spin
control.
You
didn't
change the spin
control.
No, here we
scan
the mass.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
lambda was mass.
In this case, lambda is the reduced mass.
Okay. What's the experimental span as you go between nitrogen and hydrogen isotope squared? What does that cover? In other words, what experimental range can be
With the isotopes? Well, with the isotopes, you get the different statistics, right? So if you have the 14 or 15 nitrogen, you get a totally different, because you go from fermion to boson.
That's true. So, why did you pick 15?
That's the boson.
The boson.
Yes. Didn't you have on the slides at the beginning, lambda is the spin-spin interaction when you showed the Hamiltonians at the beginning?
That is right. So maybe I should have taken the alpha that Bala was using. Oh, that. So,
Another question, if I may, that goes back to that slide where you showed the Hamiltonian. Can you repeat the argument why you actually are not considering the electric dipole-dipole interaction of the two molecules?
That is included in the potential.
It's included in the potential.
Yes,
okay. The
electronic potential has that as a dominant term, of course. Yes. Absolutely. But I said it doesn't have the same effect as the magnetic one because the dipole averages out in an n equals zero state at large distance. So at large distance, it comes in a second order and still effectively R minus six.
But still, it's 10,000 times stronger than the magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. But also there is an interesting effect of the magnetic field on the electric dipole-dipole interaction, which considerably modifies it. But it must have been, so to speak, automatically included in your calculation.
It must be there, yes.
If you...
That could be an isotope.
Yeah.
It's definitely very anisotropic and introduces additional avoided cross-sex.
Yes.
It could compete actually.
Yeah. I would say that it just blows it away.
Yeah.
It's 10,000 times stronger.
Yeah.
But it may depend on the magnetic field.
Yes.
Okay.
It's interesting, your very weak magnetic dipole changed the fundamental form of your threshold law, but the much stronger dipole didn't because of the S wave that vanishes in the absence of an electric field. So it's kind of interesting that electric dipoles and magnetic dipoles operate in fundamentally different ways, which I think some of the points that I want to make today too. So just an interesting point to keep in mind. Long-range magnetic dipoles and long-range electric
are very, very different. Yeah, for the electric dipole, you need the field to make it do something, right?
No, we talk about second order.
Yeah, but a second order, but then it becomes R minus six, so it will always lose out on the magnetic one, which...
It's an isotropy in C6.
Yes, that is an isotropy in C6. But that is also, causes R minus six, the anisotropy. The C6 too, it still goes, drops off the anisotropy, goes as down as R minus six, whereas the magnetic dipole is an R minus three term. That's why eventually it is driving the inelastic process.
But it's,
exclusively.
At shorter distances,
yes. Yeah. At shorter distances, and that is so. That is when you have this mechanism that occurs at very. I mean, here we are talking about, you know, depending on the energy of hundreds or thousands of atomic units, where the inelastic process happens, and the analytically you get it out with the Born approximation exactly, basically, because it is happening where
you have plane waves.
And short range, you get the anisotropy, and then that the total is totally different. Then it is the potential that is doing it, the reaction, the anisotropy at short range. Okay. So to summarize this, the chemical reaction is short range. It's the intramolecular spin-spin. The inelastic one, that is the intermolecular spin-spin, the magnetic one. The results, well, are not universal, which in hindsight is not too surprising, because you come in on the quintet and you don't absorb the flux on the quintet. You first need the small coupling to the triplet, so most of it goes back out on the quintet surface, and so it's not universal. And elastic and inelastic are only required the quintet potential. These cross sections, the reactive, of course, required. And below 100 millikelvin, the reaction becomes dominant. It depends weakly on the magnetic field. Right? So the inelastic you can suppress by going to a lower field, but the reactive you cannot. And so it is not great news for evaporative cooling of the NH. It doesn't totally rule it out, but it makes it more risky to try that. So maybe this was my then.
That's an interesting question. I'm actually supposed to do a Skype conference call with someone at noon. So
okay. I don't know what time it is about now.
I'm thinking.
Yes, I think
it's probably a good idea. I'd love to hear about this, but maybe we'll grab you some time and get you.
Maybe get another chance to talk about this. Yes.
Put it in somewhere else. We also have an open discussion on Friday where we'll be talking about questions that come up during the week, and maybe we can explore a little bit.
Okay.
But anyway, we'll let's stop.
All right. Thank you.